The Bain Free Radio Hour.
On the podcast, Apache Geronimo rises to haunt the canyons of cowboy punster's dreams. Banking, genetic assets, and liabilities. Plus, we continue with the complete audiobook serialization of David Weber's Uncompromising Honor. All right now. Welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour podcast. It's an honor to have you along. I'm Bain Senior Editor Tony Daniel. We talk once again to Lois McMaster-Bujold about her new book of high fantasy. This is a great one. It's Penric's Travels, it's called. And Bain publisher Tony Weisskopf joins us in the interview. It's fun discussion of all things Bujold as Lois discusses the book and life and reading and all sorts of great stuff to give you an insight into this wonderful writer. This is part two of our interview with Lois Bujold. We presented the first part on a previous podcast. Plus, we continue the complete audiobook serialization of David Weber's Honor Harrington series masterpiece, Uncompromising Honor. Now, here's the news. Hey, I want to call particular attention to our May hardcovers and trade paperbacks once more. We have these wonderful books for you, but if you are looking for the print edition, they have been a little difficult to get due to some delays with distribution channels that have been going on, and you can guess why, but that's been resolved, and the books are rolling to the booksellers right now. So if you go to your favorite online retailer, for instance, and see that a May Bain title is temporarily out of stock, don't give up on it, because it's a-coming. You might, in the meantime, check out the ebook version, which is absolutely available right now, or you can pre-order, because I will give you my holy groover oath that the books are fast on the way to Amazon, BNN.com, all the other distributors and great booksellers out there. And if you don't know what a holy groover oath is, well, you need to go dig up Dom. So as a reminder and an exhortation to find some great science fiction and fantasy reading, the May original offerings are The Shaman of Caries by Eric Flint and Dave Freer. Starship Captain Possert and the Witches of Caries must deal with a slaver culture that makes slaves feel happy to be in chains. And the youngest of the witches, the Luet, begins to awaken to her full powers as a healer. Also, a new May hardcover, and we'll talk more with Lois about this, is Penric's Travels by Lois McMaster-Bujold. Footloose nobleman Penric grows wiser and even more wily as he journeys from young lord to sorcerer and scholar in the Bastards Order. Oh, and he deals with intrigue and solves mysteries along the way. Three stories of epic fantasy from Sefwa Grandmaster Lois McMaster-Bujold. The book includes Penric's mission, Mira's last dance, and The Prisoner of Lemnos. And our May original trade paperback is science fiction novel The 11th Gate by Nancy Crest. When war breaks out between the city-states of the Eight Worlds, the key to victory and peace lies with two unlikely allies. Through the 11th Starjump Gate, at the end of which lies a planet of danger and mystery, and quantum weirdness, by the way. The 11th Gate by Nancy Kress, Penric's Travels by Lois McMaster-Bujold, and The Shaman of Caries by Eric Flint and Dave Freer are in print, on the way, or they're already now available as ebooks. Give them some special love if you can, and get some great stories and wonderful characters on the way to entertain you royally. This is part two of a two-part interview with Lois McMaster-Bujold and Tony Weisskopf discussing Penric's Travels. Part one is available on last week's podcast. Well, welcome, Lois McMaster-Bujold, and hey, Tony Weisskopf, publisher of Bain, is also with us here. Hello.
Yay. Yeah. Thank you for inviting me.
A science fiction legend, Lois McMaster-Bujold has won 7 Hugo Awards and 3 Nebula Awards. Her Miles for Kosigan saga is massively popular science fiction mainstay. Bestsellers that won those Hugos are The Vor Game, Barrayar, Mirror Dance. These were in the 90s. Paladin of Souls also won in that's not a Borges novel, in 2004, which also won a Nebula.
She's the author of many
The Locus Award.
You have several Locus as well.
Awards. In fact, for novels and novellas, things along the way. It's been a long accumulation. Yeah.
And most recently, in 2020, Lois, you were named the 36th Damon Knight Grandmaster by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, which is a high honor for that organization.
I've occasionally remarked that the meaning of any award is created by the works that have won them. And so if you look down the list of the 35 prior Grandmasters, it's like all people that, you know, pretty cool company to be in. That was neat.
Out now at Booksellers Everywhere is Penric's Travels by Lois McMaster Bujold.
The first wife had fertility problems for many, many years, which is why the concubine was brought in. And that whole story comes up in the third part of
That's The Prisoner of Lemnos.
We get into that backstory.
Because that is the story of the rescue of Nyx's mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Nyx grew up in a household that was already, you know, more complex than the American nuclear family. And she was married at a normally young age to a soldier, an officer, one of the Delos' friends. And it seemed fine, but he was killed and left her a widow, and they had not had kids yet. So she, you know, isn't sure whether it was him or her, or the fact that he was away all the time. She doesn't know if she's barren, so that's the kind of thing riding in the back of her mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, you know, should she remarry? She's of an age where women did. But the first marriage, the marriage wasn't bad, but the ending of it was disastrous. And, you know, she's not in any hurry to get back into that kind of relationship. So when she meets Penric, and is quite impressed by him, she's nonetheless, you know, not rushing into romance herself. Penric will need to court her.
Does the fact that she won't jump into bed with him interest Penric? It seems to really intrigue him because he's kind of used to girls throwing themselves at him.
It's like they hit on him because he's cute and, you know, looks good and sounds smart and all those things and washes his hands. But then they hit Desdemona and his personality and, you know, just, and he described it as... It's like a panicked pony escaping a bog. It's just take on how women react to him. It's like, no, he took on too many issues. This guy is too high maintenance. We will flee sensibly. But Nikki's is made of stronger stuff, you know, with all her army wife background and army widow background. She's been through the mill. It still takes her a bit to get over, you know, the complexities of Penric, which is actually brought up into the foreground in the middle story, Mira's Last Dance, which is a tale in which one of Penric's prior, one of Desdemona's lives, prior lives, a courtesan named Mira of Adria comes to the fore and deals with the particular situation they're in. In ways that kind of freak Nicky's out and kind of freak Pen out too, but you know, he's long for the ride and he needs the help. I got a chance to play with that. A whole bunch of things with that story.
Well, talk about some of those things because it's Penric dyes himself with henna and puts on some high heels and seduces a guy.
It's Penrick or is it Mira? Mira is very happily.
Is it Penrick or Mira? That's the question.
Spot in the spotlight, but you know, Penrick is allowing all this to happen. Because it's the right thing to do. It's getting them out of their, you know, their situation in which they have been trapped in a town, you know, on the wrong side of the border, you know, so west, giving away with Adelis, and, you know, people are looking for.
It's like he takes the role of the demons of Desdemona in this one and lets her come to the front, sort of. It's not really him, and he's sort of the advice giver.
He could pull a rein on it if he thought it was the best thing to do at any point. He could say, stop, no, we're not doing this. And Desdemona or Mira would get miffed and would have to deal with that.
What was so great about Mira that they need her here?
Oh, she's a very experienced and successful in her day. Basically, Venetian courtesan. If you've read much about them from the heyday, the golden and silver ages of Venice, who had had a whole lifestyle that was very interestingly, both within and outside the strictures. She was that type, that. Not exactly a rebel, but outside of the standard women's life course thing. And she was successful. She was good at what she did. She liked what she did. She was not downtrodden. She was, she was good in her day. So that was, that was a whole set of personality and experiences that, 19-year-old Penrick was certainly surprised by when he acquired them, but that was fun to give her a chance. And also, I thought Penrick ought to be really good at cross-dressing with Desdemona on board to stage manage it, and that was my chance to explore that idea a little bit. Could you do this, Penrick? Yes, you could. You could do it really well.
This is a fun idea, but these are serious adventures. The stakes are high for the characters involved, but they're also handled with such a deft touch that they are light as well. They don't come. I think if you gave these situations to any other writers, you would get very, very different feeling sorts of stories. And these are uniquely Bujoldian. that you can have these serious things going on, but also very, very silly things too. In some ways, deeply silly. But you're getting to explore deeply silly as well as deeply serious. That is a fun dance to watch.
It's fun to play. It's like real life is full of both comedy and tragedy at the same time.
Lois, in that Clark's World interview, you talked about humor and the use of humor in your fiction and others. You didn't like expound a philosophy or anything, but you did say something about it. What is that?
I like humor. I like a certain lightness in what I read. The drearily, thuddingly sermonistic stuff is just usually political sermons, but it's just even when it's a side I'm on, I don't want to be subjected to it as a reader. And as a writer, I suppose it's the way I look at the world. It's full of absurdity. Many horrors are actually full of absurdity, but as we see all around, especially if you read much history, which most writers do. I want the humor. I want that in my reading, in my writing as well. I noticed a trick with Terry Pratchett's Discworld, where he really takes on some very weighty themes, but nobody actually ever dies in a Discworld novel. because you have the character of death scene, you know, coming and taking away the people as their ghosts or spirits to the afterlife. So, you know, whenever there's a major death, we get this little bit of reassurance, you know, that, that the anthropomorphic character of death is taking care of it, and there is, you know, death is really death. So it's a trip that allows him to get away with a lot of stuff that, you know, you wouldn't be able to do in a more serious novel. It makes comedy out of things that would not normally be comic, because it's got that escape valve. And The World of the Five Gods does a little of the same thing in that the gods are real. There is an afterlife. You get glimpses of it. When things go wrong, you get glimpses of ghosts. So death is not an ending and a dissolution and a, you know, entry into the same oblivion you came out of. It is, you know, it is not quite so tragic, I guess.
Except for demons.
That's a gift. Demons do. If they are taken back by the god, they are rendered down to parts. They are turned into chaos. Everything that was, you know, a person about them dissolved. So demons really don't want to go back. Their death is real. That allows a slightly more comic tone in material that, you know, really wouldn't be for us.
Yeah. And all right, so, and you wouldn't say that the Last Dance of Mira is a farce or even it, but it's got a lot of those humorous Bujoldian elements that you'll find in say some of the Miles Vorkosigan books that are more like social maneuvering books rather than the straight adventures.
That oh my God, Patrick, what are you doing? Where are you taking us?
Yeah,
sort of what Miles's companions often said, I'm sure. No, this is fine.
But the next novella, The Prisoner of Lemnos, is we made a couple of more characters who are very fascinating. I really liked Tanar and Basha in particular. He's extremely competent, and he has a really interesting backstory, and he gets to... He's somebody that could actually be a problem for Penric.
But, and Basha's not a bad guy, but he could be...
Not a bad guy. He's got some dodgy elements. Yeah, he was a character that darn near hijacked the book. He had so much life and so much interest. He has a lot of historical precedents, things I had read about, went into him. And he's so alive. Some characters are like that. They hit the stage running and, you know, and they will gallop off with you in all directions. You let them. No, you're
well,
a secondary character. Still down.
Until he gets his own book, yes.
That's one of the possibilities. Of, you know, another direction I could go off in is to go. But at the time of this story, Sorokos Bosha is 40. So, you know, a lot of his wilder adventures are, you know, back behind him. And you would be writing, basically, you'd be writing a prequel or a backstory story if I did those. And the front story gets involved with other places I'm not sure where I want what to do with yet. He has a whole backstory worked out. I should explain for, you know, readers who are just turning in, it's just like hearing people talk about somebody you haven't met at a party. Sorokos Bosha is the eunuch secretary of a character named Lady Tanar, who is Adelis's, not quite lost love, but certainly parted from sweetheart since he was exiled and she's still back in Sidonia. And she's the one who sends the word that Nikis's mother has been arrested and sequestered on in an island nunnery by the imperial government, and they have to go rescue her, hence the prisoner of Lemnos. Lemnos is the name of the island. Sorokos Bosha is of a type that you see in a lot of different literatures in the kind of imperial governments or other places where they had eunuchs. The Chinese is another one that has a whole literary tradition about them and historical. And Byzantium likewise practiced that quite a bit. And Rome, ancient Rome, it fell out of favor in the Middle Ages, but was actually in ancient times much more practiced. And so reading up on both the Byzantium and the Chinese models is, and in both history and fiction has been fascinating. The admiral who commanded that Chinese fleet that, you know, almost but didn't quite discover Europe back in the 15th, 14th century, whichever dates that were, he was the eunuch, he was court eunuch type. And there was a interesting tension in the Chinese court between the cadre of eunuchs who took care of the emperor, and also in the, it's identically in the Byzantine court, and had kind of the ear and the inner, you know, the inner household, and the educated bureaucrats who made up the government. Yeah. Which of us should be in charge here? And since the educated bureaucrats are mainly responsible for writing the histories, the eunuchs don't get very good press. In either either the Imperial Byzantine or the Imperial Chinese histories. But sometimes with good reason. Sometimes it's, you know, it's pretty clearly, you know, two groups each struggling for ascendancy or for power. So that's that was a really interesting compare and contrast. Yeah. So he's of the type, but Cercos Bosio is of that Byzantine type, but he's out of it. He was in the government. The emperor he was, you know, working for was toppled, as frequently happens. He kind of got caught on the wrong side of the coup and ended up in private service to Lady Tanner at a fairly early age, his mid-20s, I think. He's been with her ever since. So he's the loyal retainer with the interesting backstory.
Well, he has these knives that are all poisoned in various ways, for instance, and he's very good at preparing the poisons.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you can't afford to lose a fight, which he wouldn't be, he would be given no quarter in any, you know, physical fight. You better be sure that you're going to get away. He learned that the hard way in his 20s, too. Still has the scars. But yeah, he was a great character.
Tanner, basically, part of the backstory is that he showed up wounded and she nursed him as her sort of imaginary friend in her treehouse for a little while. So he has this huge devotion to her.
Yeah. She was like 6 and he was like 24, 26, something like that. Yeah. And she kind of, he was so bemused and, you know, so dependent. And she was such a personality, you know, that they just fell into this pattern and have been in it ever since, to both of their.
And you compare, it's the relationship between Tanner and Bosia to, and the fact that if Adelis marries her, he's going to have to, you know, basically marry Bosia too, because he's not going anywhere, to the way that it would be if Nicus, eventually hooks up and stays with Penrick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the problem of dealing with someone who comes with baggage that they're not going to be putting down. Penrick comes with Desdemona. Tanner comes with Bosia. Yeah. So that parallel, you know, it's drawable. You know, it's, I'm not sure Bosia would be thrilled with it. There you go.
That's his opinion. Were there any other characters in Penrick that kind of started to run away with you, or?
I'm not sure. Every once in a while, a character comes popping out of the plot. You know, popping out of the box. You need a character to do this thing. So you come up with this character to do this thing, and all of a sudden, they have backstory. They have opinions. They have life, and blood. And the one that kind of popped up in Prisoner of Lydnos was Nicky's half-brother, the bridge builder. Rodoa, Icos Rodoa, turns up quite unexpectedly mid-book to both the characters and to me. and he's of this type, Roman architect builder type, which I'd also been reading up a lot about. So he sopped up all that, all that backstory, and it became him very quickly. he didn't have a large part, but he was a character.
Yeah, he's another interesting momentary character is Curato, the sorcerer that Penric faces at the end of Penric's mission.
Right, yes, another temple sorcerer with a little different style. Because every demon is different on account of having been in different people and having different, track records. Whether they've been in one person or six makes a difference in the power and knowledge base of the demon. Every temple sorcerer is different. They're not stamped out of a mold. So again, as a writer, I get a lot of opportunity to play with the various possibilities in this very Protean system.
Well, we were talking earlier about that you've taken up anime as a hobby, and we were also talking about the tropes in anime are different than that in historical Western literature. Do you find that popping up in this series that you're using a slightly different set of expectations in this series than you have previously?
I'm not sure. I've been watching anime for many years. I first encountered it back in film rooms at science fiction conventions in the mid-80s when there were no translations and the fan would be standing up there trying to do simultaneous translation and explain this thing to a bewildered but interested audience. Fans had never seen it. And then in the 90s, it began to trickle into the video cassette rental stores. Remember those? But there would only be the second volume of some series. Frustrating to try to follow any stories. But it was clear that it was a different kind of thing. I was working off a different set of mythologies with which I was less familiar. Different ideas of the supernatural and how it worked. The whole reincarnation shtick and all this memory stuff that goes with it. Memory and amnesia goes right with the reincarnation tropes. So a whole bunch of cultural assumptions. And then we get further into it, you begin to see, this is Taoism and this is Buddhism and this is Shinto and this is this other piece of Asian mythology that and they're all kind of brought together to play with each other or play off each other in modern stories. I better find out more about Buddhism or you won't understand what the heck is going on in this story. The Buddhists deal with the corpses and the Shinto don't because they regard corpses as ritually unclean, so they do the weddings. All right, that's how that's divided up. So you learn these things. Kind of by immersion, if you watch it. But anyway, that way, early 2000s, I got Netflix and I got way more access and became gradually more familiar.
Which ones do you like?
There's a very long list. at the top is always the Shishi, which is a really hard to describe one about a character named Ginkgo. He is an itinerant medicine seller with supernatural abilities, and he studies a subject called Mushi, which are supernatural sublife entities that appear and work. They're kind of like nature spirits, and they create problems sometimes, but they're not necessarily evil, and they don't necessarily need to be killed, but they need to be understood. And so he's kind of a Mushi naturalist. As he moves around through these stories, each story is very few of them. Almost all the chapters or episodes are a single independent story, and Ginkgo moves through the world, and you move with him. It's a great character, so that's a good one. And then there's thousands of others. Probably not thousands, hundreds maybe by now. there's a bunch of stuff from Crunchyroll. which is an anime streaming service that I signed up for a few years ago. Gotten my money's worth out of that subscription. And there's everything from, you know, adventure stories, way too many junior high school stories, superhero stuff, Japanese historical fantasy, lots of that. I got my fill of giant fighting robots way early on. I don't bother with those anymore. The whole genre called mecha. You just give those a skip, and I skip all the horror, and I skip all the most of the samurai stuff, not all of it. But that still leaves a lot. Yeah, a lot of, you know, yokai are the Japanese supernatural little creatures that can take all kinds of forms. So anything with yokai in it, yeah, I look at. Another one that came by recently that particular interest is something called Thunderbolt Fantasy, which is Taiwanese traditional puppetry, for which they did a collaboration with Japanese anime people, and the anime people wrote the script and did voicing. Evidently, when the puppetry is done as stage puppetry, one narrator does all the voices. But it's just astonishing costuming and puppetry work and whatnot. So they've made several of those, and they're grand fun. I refer to them as Taiwanese murder Muppets because there's a lot of beheading and stage blood.
That sounds like fun.
And there are many more. We could go on for hours, but perhaps shouldn't.
Maybe I have a question for Tony and maybe you as well. Why and how did it come about that we brought these novellas that Lois had been, you know, experimenting with and publishing and e-publishing and such, in apart from the fact that, you know, we just wanted to have another Bujold book out, of course. What was the process of bringing these together and the story behind it happening?
It really started from, you know, the fans. I brought these things out as e-novellas, which I thought would be like a la carte, and, you know, existing off in their own little e-bubble and, you know, being my retirement project. And, like, within 15 minutes, people are saying, when are we going to be able to get it on paper? It's like, you still read on paper? Okay. then Subterranean Press, which does limited edition deluxe little hardcovers, picked them up. And they were successful enough that they've continued to pick up each novella as a separate collectible thing, but that's pricey. You know, but you get your money's worth. I mean, they're good little books, lovely little books, but they're not a mass market, you know, reach everybody edition. They're like 2,000 copies and that's it. So that was cool, but it wasn't what the fans who wanted it on paper were talking about. So I was thinking, okay, let's think about this, but I knew I wanted to make them be collections, like going back to Borders of Infinity, that first Miles collection for Bane with the three novellas. Talking a little about the history of that, I had written the first novella, The Borders of Infinity, at Betsy Mitchell, then Bane editor's invitation. She was putting together a series of these things, and it came out with another novella by Orson Scott Card and one by David Drake, which was great for introducing me to, like, you know, more readers at that time in the late 80s. But that was the first novella I'd ever written, and I really liked the length. So I, you know, was happy to revisit that idea. And it seemed like three is about the right number. It makes your 100,000 words and some change that, you know, is what people expect novels, you know, books to be. Used to be 80,000, but, you know, inflation. And I knew I wanted them to be, you know, in order. I wasn't exactly writing them in order. And then we had to wait for the Subterranean Press exclusive period to run out, which was short, you know, by publishing standards. So it wasn't something I could do right away. And meanwhile, I was writing more. And so the idea of the collection of two sets of three, yeah, kind of came into focus about the time I was working on the fourth one or so. So I wanted to wait, do them as a pair, and do them in an organized fashion. So that's how you got them, when you did.
Well, doing it that way, too, let us have the same cover artist. We could give him both books at the same time, and mm-hmm. he could really get a feel for the character as well. So that was a nice thing for us to do. We get the great Dan Dos Santos to do those covers. And,
yeah, he's a new artist for me. I've gotten a lot of compliments and good remarks about those covers. People are really liking them. So but they look classy.
Well, Dan is winning awards for them as well, I should mention. So,
One of them was nominated. I don't know what happened after the nomination, whether it won or whether it's gone by already, but I was glad to see that. I hope he felt validated.
Yep. Well, Dan, like Lois, Dan gets his influences from a lot of different places, and is mm-hmm. always absorbing new ideas and new forms and experimenting with his own works. So it's a good match mm-hmm. For these guys. So
yeah, they were very intelligent covers.
Yeah.
It's maybe Tony, you can describe the Penrick's Travel cover with because the demon is very hard to represent visually. Dan figured a way to do it.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, we just did a version of the Bane Traveling Road Show where we got to do all artists. Dan was actually not part of it, but that's up at our Facebook page. For those who haven't been to a convention or seen it, it's a PowerPoint presentation where we show the beautiful artwork, and then we show the beautiful cover, and we talk about the books and we talk about the art and how it's created and so on. And usually at a given convention, you don't have a lot of artists at them, or the artists are way too busy, like DragonCon, to participate in much programming. Mm-hmm. But because we're doing them virtually, we got to have this all-star cast of Bane artists. We had about 10 different guys and ladies commenting on their art and the art that we had. And several of these guys are at the stage in their career where they're also teaching. Todd Lockwood is teaching, and Sam Kennedy has just started teaching, and David Mattingly's been teaching for a while. So they can really, you know, they can talk very, very enthusiastically and articulately about the work. And I don't remember where I was going with this, but I know where I was going with this.
Hopefully, reaction to Don DeSanto's covers. But go ahead.
Well, it is fun to hand these guys covers that are not easy, because they are up to the challenge, and mm-hmm. they enjoy challenges. They rise to the challenge. This was one that wasn't easy, but I think that Dan really got a good mm-hmm. grip on being able to, because Desdemona is important. She needs to be on the cover. But uh-huh. how you represent these women and the lioness and the horse. The lioness and the horse didn't make it into this cover, but they were on the previous cover. So
I was amused by that.
They are an integral part of Penrick, so they have uh-huh. to be on the cover. But how do you take this and make this literal? Uh-huh. The answer is you can't. But you can make it visual. In this case, we have portraits of the women who have been hosts for the demon, and each of the women has their own feel in this. So it's not just a portrait mm-hmm. of Penrick, it's also a portrait of everybody else, and also a beautiful sea scene as well. So,
as many as will fit onto that frieze, you know, because if you put all 10, yeah. it would be too crowded, and artists would be complaining about. Yeah. But, it was an interesting way of putting it all together. Yeah. I like that one. I'm also very partial to blue, so yeah, the seascape and everything looks good. Henrik in his book, looking very bookish, as he should.
Well, Tony also had it framed up, which is interesting, and the raised tie. It's just a beautiful. Tony is the artistic director here as well as the boss. And she had it. I really like the packaging of the beauty of the bookiness of the cover.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, if you've got great art, you know, covering it up with a lot of lettering is wasting your money and talent. So it's like, yeah, put your lettering on the outside and you can see the art and, life is good.
Yeah, well, we put your name pretty big, Lois.
Mm-hmm. Now that too.
Well, you're not going to waste a good name either, so.
Yeah. That works. That works. Yeah, I was pleased with the Penix Travels cover.
Well, I think it's going to be fun if we do get to do a third volume to see what Dan comes up with for the next one. So, fingers crossed.
Yeah, I've got 2 out of 3, but I don't know what the third one is because I just finished it last week. taking the summer
off
pressure. And then
we'll see. No pressure.
Mm-hmm. There's lots of things I could do, I could go off in another direction. For example, I did Knife Children earlier this last year, and Subterranean Press just brought that, which is a kind of codicil story to the Sharing Knife tetralogy. I had been a notion in my head for a very long time, and it was finally time. The characters presented themselves, and the opening scene, and actually the opening scene had been in my head for a very long time, but I didn't know where it went right after that. It always began with Barr shaving off his Luthlian beard, his winter beard, and preparing to go find Lily and finding the place burned down. But then it was, what I ended up with was a very different story than my first notion.
One of the fun details that in Penric's Travels is the way that Penric shaves, which comes up.
Yeah, if you've got a demon, there's all kinds of little domestic tricks you could do with a bit of chaos magic if it's properly controlled. I haven't thought through all of them, but. So you just wipe it off. It's like depilatory without the depilatory. And then there's the insect control and lighting fires. And Desdemona points out in Penric's very first tutorial back in Penric's Demon, all these things sound great, but the problem with them is that you also can't prove you didn't do them. So if a fire starts, is it you? You're the sorcerer. You might have done. The sorcerers tend to be very discreet about their magics because it's all invisible. We alas do not have people flinging fireballs at each other in great magical combats. It's all stealthy and biological and invisible and can pass completely unnoticed. There's actually an aspect of that I've been thinking about with Penric's world and the invisible and magic, but the fact that magic is real. Magical accusations can be disproven. Thinking of all the Middle Ages in our world and all the witch hunts and whatnot, In this world, if someone is accused of magic, you can actually get somebody out there who can say yes or no. And if it's no, then, it's like they're off the hook. They didn't do it.
I think that sounds like a Penric legal drama. That would be a great novella.
It would.
I have a box with not enough ideas in it. It's been rattling around for a while of those notions, the kind of thing that he would be sent out to check out. And then, that's the basic notion, but what are the complications that would make the story? Before I get too far away from it, I'd like to do more with his relationship with the Princess Archdivine back in Martin's Bridge. Fun to explore a little more. Who knows?
Well, we will look forward to reading it if and when it comes around, and if it's not that one, then we'll look forward to reading the next one that comes. So.
There will be something else. Yeah, I've learned to be very careful what I mention, because people will take it and run with it, and, you know, think it was a promise when it was just me gabbing. Not future projects.
Well, there's so much else that we could talk about. I did want briefly to just ask you, because you talk about it, and it really was intriguing in that Clark's World interview, was the purpose of fiction as opposed to nonfiction. You just like touched on it a little bit, and before we go, I'd really like you to tease us a little with your thoughts on that, if you don't mind, Lois.
Well, fiction, well, we do learn about the world through fiction, but it's all filtered through the mind of the fiction writer. You know, you only get what they understood given back to you. And if you want to know about the world, you read nonfiction, which is also filtered, you realize, after a while through the brain of a particular writer and, you know, edited down. You have to learn to take that with a grain of salt, too. So maybe fiction reading teaches you how to read nonfiction more closely. But, yeah, I think fiction is doing a different job. Fiction that informs is fun, but I think what fiction really does is play with the emotions. That's what art does generally. You know, it's not something that, you know, has an obvious biological necessity, you know, evolved thing, like vision or sight or any of the other things that human brains do. You know, it's not at all clear how this becomes, you know, something that helps people survive and reproduce. So it's like, why art? Why do we even have the capacity for art? It's at the moment a question without an answer, but it seems to be, you know, a very human thing. And art, I think, is ultimately about emotions. If it's about information, it would be nonfiction. You know, it would be manuals, you know. And that's not what art is doing. It is doing something else. And I think the artist or writer who can evoke emotions in people is the one who's going to be getting the response. However, the many ways you can do that. But yeah, emotion doesn't get good press, but I think that's what it's doing underneath.
There's a lot of food for thought there.
Yeah. Well, we hope that you continue evoking emotions, and we certainly evoke a lot of emotions at a vast spectrum in Penrick's Travels, which is out now, Booksellers Everywhere by Lois McMaster Bujold. Lois and Tony, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Been a pleasure.
Thank you, Tony.
That was part two of a two-part interview with Lois McMaster Bujold and Tony Weisskopf discussing Penrick's Travels. Part one is available on last week's podcast. Here is another entry in David Weber's Honor Harrington series masterpiece, Uncompromising Honor. Honor keeps her promise. The Solarian League. For hundreds of years, they have borne the banner of human civilization. But the bureaucratic mandarins who rule today's league are corrupt and looking for scapegoats. They've decided the upstart Star Kingdom of Manticore must be annihilated. Uncompromising courage. Honor Harrington has worn the Star Kingdom's uniform for half a century. Very few know war the way Honor Harrington does. So far, hers has been a voice of caution. But now the Mandarins have committed atrocities such as the galaxy has not known in 1,000 years. They have finally killed too many of the people Honor Harrington loves. Uncompromising vengeance. Now Honor Harrington is coming for the Solarian League, and hell is riding in her wake. And now, David Weber's Uncompromising Honor.
August 1922, post-diaspora. SLNS Quebec. Cachalot System.
You can't be serious.
The woman on Vincent Capriotti's comm display was platinum-haired and dark-skinned. It was a striking combination, and she was so photogenic, he suspected she'd been the recipient of quite a lot of biosculpt. Politicians, as a rule, found physical attractiveness a valuable asset, far more valuable, in fact, in Capriotti's opinion, than simple competence. On the other hand, Cachalot System President Miriam Yonka had amply demonstrated her own competence over a 40-year political career. And at the moment, the fury blazing in her brown eyes honed her attractiveness in much the same way lightning honed a thunderstorm's, or a hurricane's, perhaps. I'm afraid I'm quite serious, Madam President, he said in reply, then sat back to wait out the 6-minute communications lag. At the moment, TF-783 was almost 56 million kilometers from the planet Orca, just over 10 light minutes inside the Cachalot System hyperlimit, closing with the planet at 18,119 kPS and decelerating at a steady 300 G. Given that geometry, they would reach Orca orbit in another hour and 40 minutes, and their recon platforms had been swarming around the inner system for the last couple of hours. ONI had grudgingly admitted that stealth systems were another area in which the Mantis had somehow acquired a commanding lead, but nobody's stealth was good enough to hide warships, even completely shut down warships, from the horde of drones he'd sent speeding ahead of his ships. Which means there's absolutely no reason I can't carry out Buccaneer, damn it, he thought grimly. The odds are we'll be the first task force to execute it too, which means I'm the one going down in the friggin' history books. I don't think I'm going to like that. At least it also meant there'd be no need or any possible excuse for Parthian. There'd be ample time for an orderly evacuation, and thank God for it. He'd waited until he was positive that would be the case, and until the comm lag was at least semi-manageable, before contacting Yonka's office and telling her why he was here. Her response had been pretty much what he'd anticipated. You have no conceivable justification for this, she snapped now from her display. It's a blatantly illegal action against an independent and neutral star system. It violates at least a half dozen interstellar treaties, treaties the Solarian League both negotiated and guaranteed, and every conceivable canon of interstellar law. All of which was absolutely true and had nothing at all to do with his orders, Capriotti thought. I'm very sorry you feel that way, Madam President, he said. And speaking as an individual and not as an officer of the Solarian League Navy, I understand why you do. I deeply regret the orders I've been given, but I have no option but to carry them out, and I intend to do so. At the same time, my orders emphasize the vital importance of minimizing any possible avoidable loss of life. Which was also true, as long as Parthian wasn't on the table. That's why I'm speaking to you now, to inform you that you have 72 hours to complete your evacuation of the infrastructure in question. He waited for his words to reach her, and saw her expression when they did. If she could have reached him in that moment, she would have ripped out his throat with her bare hands, he thought. This system has maintained cordial and cooperative relations with the Solarian League since the year the League was created, she told him flatly. We have never, in all those centuries, been anything but your Star Nation's friendly neighbor, and we certainly aren't participants in any aggression against the League. We're not Solarians, we aren't Manticorans, and we've been scrupulously neutral. We don't even have a navy, only a system police force. What you propose is not only blatantly illegal, but an atrocity carried out against the life's blood of my star system. She had an excellent point, he reflected. Not that he intended to admit that Cachalot's lack of a navy was one of the main reasons he'd been sent here. Madam President, I'm prepared to grant that you haven't been military participants in the so-called Grand Alliance's aggression against the Solarian League, he said. He knew he was speaking for the record, that this entire comm exchange was probably going to wind up on the public boards throughout the League, and he forced himself to sound calm, measured, and above all, reasonable. It was hard when what he actually felt was bitter shame. But he was a senior officer of the SLN, and he had his orders. Even though you may not have aided the Manticorans and their allies militarily, however, he continued, You've certainly aided and abetted them in other ways. As your government is well aware, Manticore began its campaign against the Salarian League by way of its blatantly illegal interference with freedom of astrogation and the Salarian economy. In effect, Manticore has weaponized interstellar commerce and directed it against the Salarian League because of my government's refusal to simply stand aside and enable its raw, unbridled imperialism through our passivity. And, Madam President, your star system has transferred virtually the entirety of its own trade to Manticore and the other star nations, who, by their own declaration, are now actively at war with the League. That's hardly the action of an even-handed neutral, and my government has no option but to consider active collaboration with outlaw regimes which have killed hundreds of thousands of Salarian military personnel and citizens an act of aggression. He met Yanka's eyes steadily, even though both of them knew just how tenuous the connection between reality and what he'd just said truly was. The Salarian League takes no pleasure in the destruction of property, and my government is well aware of the economic hardship this will create for the people of your star nation. He went on in a tone of implacable regret, filling the transmission lag with the rest of the talking points with which the Navy and Foreign Affairs had seen fit to provide him. If he gave her the opportunity to respond, she'd probably point out that Manticore's version of commerce warfare meant the Star Empire and its allies were the only people with whom Cachalot could trade at the moment, and his lords and masters could never have that as part of the official record now, could they? However, it's clear Manticore has embraced an imperialism which is as much economic as territorial. Not content with the commanding position it already enjoyed, it's now set out to secure dictatorial control of the entire inhabited galaxy's economic life. The Salarian League cannot and will not allow any star nation to acquire that sort of power, of control and coercion, over its star systems and their citizens. And since it's evident that raw aggression and economic domination are the only languages the Star Empire understands, the League has no option but to respond to it in its own terms. Much as I may regret the mission which has brought me to your star system, your complicity in Manticore's assault upon the Salarian League has left my government with no other alternative. Again, I inform you that you have 72 hours in which to organize an evacuation of your orbital infrastructure. Obviously, I must also insist on the surrender of the armed units of your system patrol. Vice Admiral Angelica Helland, my chief of staff, will be in contact with the System Patrol's commanding officer to arrange that surrender in as peaceful and orderly a fashion as possible. I'm sure I've presented you with a great many unpleasant decisions and actions. Again, I regret the necessity of doing so, but I will leave you to deal with them. I will contact you again when my flagship enters Orca orbit. Caprioti, clear. He pressed the stud to kill his comm and swiveled his chair to face Commodore Anthony, his staff communications officer. "Until I contact her again, I'm unavailable, Roger," he said. Anthony's eyebrows rose ever so slightly, and it was obvious from his expression that he didn't look forward to fending off Yonka's inevitable fiery demands to speak to Capriotti, but the Commodore only nodded. Capriotti returned the nod, then turned back to the master plot as Quebec and the rest of the task force decelerated toward Orca. He watched the moving icons and wondered how much of his unavailability stemmed from the PR requirements and psychological warfare aspects of Buccaneer, and how much of it stemmed from shame. He remembered his words to Captain Timberlake in their first discussion of the Ops Order, and they were bitter on his tongue. This wasn't the reason he'd joined the Navy, but if he had to do it, then he'd damned well do it.
"We're ready, sir,"
Liang Tao Rutger said quietly. Capriotti nodded without speaking. He stood with his hands clasped behind him, gazing into the flag bridge plot. It had been reconfigured for visual display, showing him a needle-sharp vista of the planet Orca and the massive orbital infrastructure about it. Cachalot had been settled for a long time, but it wasn't the best real estate in the known galaxy. Despite the relative dimness of the system primary, whose luminosity was less than 14% that of Sol, Orca's close orbit, the planetary year was less than 3 T-months long, produced a mean temperature significantly higher than Old Terra's. Its tropical zone was virtually uninhabited, and its axial inclination was only 9 degrees, which meant it had minimal seasonal variation even outside the all-but-unendurable tropics. There were, however, almost 5 billion human beings in its temperate zones, and another 3 billion in its orbital habitats. That was a lot of people to turn into implacable haters, he thought. At least the Cachalotians had opted for a sharper segregation between their industrial platforms and their habitats than happened in most star systems. That had probably started initially because so many of them had opted for the habitats' controlled climates in preference to the planets from the very beginning. That meant the inhabited neighborhood had grown up even before its industrial base really developed, and separating them had protected their orbital population from the sorts of industrial accidents that could have unfortunate consequences. It had to create commuting problems for a lot of their labor force, but they clearly thought it was worth it, and their building codes had officially enshrined the separation for several centuries now. Of course, they'd never seen an industrial accident like Buccaneer coming. They were still going to lose one orbital habitat, and the homes of over 5 million of their citizens anyway. There simply wasn't any way to demolish the Siesta Three platform's industrial capability without taking out the entire habitat. Three more major habitats were going to take significant damage, but Rutgers' demolition crews were confident the housing sections would survive unhurt. Not so confident that Yanka or me was going to leave those people aboard when the charges go off. Capriotti snorted mentally. It's a lot easier to be confident about somebody else's homes, he thought harshly. Even without minor considerations like that, destroying the platforms in Orca orbit without creating catastrophic debris strikes on both the planet and the remaining habitats was a non-trivial exercise in its own right. The Snapper Belt platforms, better than 50 light minutes from the primary, were a much simpler proposition. Snapper, 644,000 inhabitants, had simply been moved en masse to Orca's surface, and a dozen of Capriotti's destroyers would take out the belt's entire infrastructure with targeted missile launches. Closer to the planet, that was a non-starter, however, and he considered the battle cruisers positioned around the first of Rutgers' targets. Very well, Liang Tao, he sighed finally. Proceed. Yes, sir. Capriotti stayed where he was, watching the visual, as the battle cruisers brought up their impeller wedges. The three major platforms, two fabrication centers, and one of Orca's six primary freight platforms, remained clearly visible from Quebec's more distant orbit. The activated wedges completely enclosed them on three sides, however, cutting off direct visual observation from the planetary surface or any of Orca's other near-planet habitats or space stations. Detonation in 15 seconds. Mark, Rutgers said clearly behind him. 15, 10, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The nuclear charges detonated simultaneously in bursts of brilliance which hurt the eye. That had to be purely psychosomatic, Capriotti thought, even as he blinked against the brightness. The display automatically filtered their intensity more rapidly than mere organic nerves could respond to it, after all. Maybe it was just that he knew what they must have looked like to the unshielded eye. Not even a nuclear blast could completely vaporize several billion tons of space station. That was why he'd placed his battlecruiser's impeller wedges to intercept any debris. They'd hold their stations until he was positive nothing could get through to Orca or any of the other platforms. Then they'd move on to the next targets on their list. He stood for another 15 seconds, gazing at the spot where the next best thing to 2 millennia of investment and the livelihoods of 1.7 million people had just been wiped from the cosmos. Then he drew a deep breath and looked over his shoulder at his staff. Keep me informed, especially about any debris fields, he said. I'll be in my quarters. Of course, sir, Vice Admiral Helland responded for the entire staff. He nodded to them and walked from the flag bridge in silence.
That was another entry in the complete audiobook serialization of Uncompromising Honor by David Weber. And that's it for the podcast. thanks to Audible.com and to podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And the brush of a god's wing to mend the bursitis of such long life and protect against the oppressor's wrong, the law's delay, the slings and arrows of such longbow life, plus thanks, praise, and gratitude for Tony Weisskopf and Lois McMaster Bujold, science fiction grandmaster and author of Penrick's Travels. Please join us next time here at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.